Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP, hosted by Eli Mazur. This episode of Clause 8 is unlike any previous episode. In fact, you could easily have a whole podcast about the story of Gil Hyatt and only barely scratch the surface. He is one of the most significant American innovators in the field of personal computing, the inventor of the microprocessor, and he has been involved in a David versus Goliath battle with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office for more than 20 years. When Eli was first approached about interviewing Gil, he was excited about the opportunity to talk with him and better understand and tell a story. But truthfully, shortly after he started having doubts about whether he wanted to get in the middle and how much clarity he could add to Gil's journey. Nonetheless, it's a story that needed to be told. There are many levels to this story. It's not only a story about innovation, America's patent system, and dealing with the USPTO. It's a story about how an American government agency can secretly make up and rewrite rules to target particular individuals.
All right, Gil, thank you so much for joining us. You obviously have a fascinating story on so many levels, and there's so many intricacies to it, so hopefully we can cover some of it, but thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
So I guess in the technology community, you're known as an inventor of the microprocessor and really starting what's now known as a personal computing revolution for the smartphones that we have. In the IP community, you're known for a years-long battle with the USPTO. Can you take us back? Do you remember when you first learned about the patent system? Was it during engineering school, before that? Do you remember when you first became aware that there are patents and there is a patent system in the United States?
I learned about patents back in the late 1960s when Teledyne, the employer that I was working for at the time, filed for patent applications on some of my inventions, and I got 3 patents from that.
And I guess shortly after you quit Teledyne and you went on your own, what impact did the existence of patents have on you being willing to take that risk?
At that time, I wasn't patents knowledgeable, and therefore I was more concentrating on getting a product out the door. We got venture capital, we're manufacturing microcomputer systems and selling them. The management decided to file patent applications, and still I was uninitiated into the patent system at that time.
Let's go back a little bit. How did you come up with the idea even to innovate the microprocessor? How did that idea come to you? And how did you decide to focus on that?
In the mid and late 1960s, I realized that computers, large computers, and down to mini computers, were much more powerful than needed and much more expensive than could be afforded for most systems. So I came up with my concept of a computer that was very small, very inexpensive. It wouldn't do a lot compared to the mini computers and large-scale computers, but for most applications, you didn't need a computer to do very much. So I came up with a concept. The field was evolving where computers were getting much bigger and more powerful, and I worked on making a computer that was much smaller, less powerful, and very cheap.
And when you were working on this problem, were you aware of anybody else who was working at that problem at the time when you first started?
No, it was actually going in the opposite direction. It turned out that my work got into the venture capital community and took off because they weren't very discreet about it. They got funding for my company, got me to a certain point, and then closed down the company and gave it away.
From what I understand, you were saying that when you started your company, you got a venture capital funding, you were planning to manufacture the computers yourself, and your management is the one who really took the initiative to file the patent applications. Do you know if they had some kind of strategy in mind in terms of, you know, we need to file these patent applications, we'll delay the grant of them until, I guess, what was the purpose of the patent applications they filed? Did they have any strategy in mind at the time?
Yes, the strategy was the same as my strategy today, to get patents, to get venture capital, because we're protected with patents, and then to get the products to market. There was no delay. It was a matter of expediting it, because the sooner we got patents, the sooner we could get venture capital to expand the business model. But I'd like to mention that at my company, which I they're called Microcomputer Incorporated. Yeah. We weren't manufacturing computers per se. We were manufacturing systems because the business model was that when you reduce a computer to being a chip, it's not a good business to be in. Therefore, you need to use a proprietary chip to build systems that can do a lot more than the previous non-computer systems, but at the same price for a great competitive advantage.
I think you made it clear that the reason you filed the patents is, you know, to go with your own products to market and protect them. But at the time, I guess this was before 1995, the way the patent system worked was that you either got 20 years from filing date or 17 years from when the patent was granted. Did you give any thought to that, how those 17 years could be advantageous until your product is adopted on a more commercially large scale? At the time when you were starting your company, did you give any thought about that?
Absolutely not. That is a concept that has come to pass in recent years, and it's a false concept. Yeah. The concept was always to get patent protection so that you can protect your products in the marketplace and to get investment capital to expand on it when you had patent protection. Delay is a fallacy that has been presented in recent years and was not the concept back then. I would mention that back then, the term was always 17 years. Yeah. In response to what you said. The 20-year term did not come up until the mid-1990s when the foreign patent offices and the large businesses tried to reduce the value of patents, and they got Congress to change the patent term.
From what I understand, among your investors were really the founders of Intel. And at a certain point, they came to you and they said, let's sign an agreement that if your company goes out of business, we'll own all the IP rights. And you refused to go along with that. Can you tell us why was it so important to you to maintain those patent rights?
I knew at that early date, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, that the microcomputer would be a major technological advantage. And I was unwilling to give it away because it was clear to me that the investors were trying to take over my company, Microcomputer Inc., and I wouldn't go along with that.
It seems like it was a huge gamble on your part, right? Or did you not see it that way?
I didn't see it that way because there was no downside risk when they took it over. Essentially, what venture capital does is gets rid of the founders, takes it over, and uses the technology and the products, gives it to whatever companies that they think are more suitable to carry forward their investments.
And I read, so after your company was shut down, you became an aerospace consultant, but yet you continue to file patent applications. That's a very expensive process. It's a very time-consuming process. I guess, what motivated you to keep doing that after your whole experience with your company?
I had significant technologies, and I needed to get venture capital to take them to market. And in order to get venture capital, I needed patents, as the venture capital community clearly told me. But I couldn't afford to pay for patent attorneys to file my patent applications. Therefore, I studied and learned the process myself. I became registered with the patent office as a patent agent. I'm not an attorney. Yeah. And I drafted and filed the patent applications myself, hoping to get them issued. And actually, I got a whole stream of patents issued in the 1970s, 1980s, actually into the 1990s, until the patent office decided that it wasn't going to issue me any more patents.
So it seems like you were getting a lot of patents issued, but it took almost 20 years to get your most significant, I guess, innovation issued for the microprocessor. You filed that, I think, in 1970, and it's finally granted in July of 1990. Why did it take so long for that?
It's a very slow process where you file a patent application. The patent office takes time to examine it. You then appeal to the Board of Appeals. The Patent Office realized it was a significant invention and was unwilling to issue the patent on it. The time delay for the Board of Appeals added to that. And then when I lost at the Board of Appeals, I appealed it to the federal courts, and they took their time. So therefore, it's a long time-consuming process. Unfortunately, they blame the delays on the applicants when, in fact, it's part of the process of examination and appeal.
Was that frustrating? It seemed like this was a foundational invention. It should have been actually easy for them to grant a patent because you clearly came first. It wasn't just an incremental invention.
Excuse me. To the contrary, the Patent Office takes the position that they will not issue foundational, or as they call it, pioneering patents. Yeah. And therefore, if you have a pioneering application, pioneering invention, then it will be much harder to get it issued rather than easier.
That's fascinating and frustrating, I imagine. And the fact that you had to take it all the way up to the Federal Circuit, that was an expensive process, I imagine. You know, you filed the patent applications yourself, but I'm guessing that by the time it was going to Federal Circuit, you had to hire attorneys.
Actually not. I wasn't able to do so. I was supporting myself and my research and development by consulting in the aerospace industry. So I filed the appeals by myself.
Wow.
And the Federal Circuit, and actually I think their predecessor, the CCPA, gave me guidance as to what they didn't like about my previous work.
Yeah.
So that I filed what is called a continuation, which I corrected those problems, and the Patent Office then issued the patents.
I think a lot of people, or most people, would have just given up at that point, you know, having to take something all the way to an appeals court. I guess, what do you think separates you that kind of, you kept going on your own, you know, learning how to draft Federal Circuit briefs?
I was caught in a dilemma. I was convinced that that my technologies, not only the microcomputer, but the ones that followed, were very, very important. And yet I wasn't able to afford the normal patent attorney processes. So I had to learn how to do it myself and was in a lot of ways successful. I did get a lot of patents issued myself, and I did get a lot of favorable decisions from the Patent Office Board of Appeals.
Did you try to get any investors to fund your battle to get that foundational patent?
Yes, it turned out to be a catch-22 situation because the venture community says you need patents to show us that you can protect your inventions. And in order to get patents, you need capital to prosecute them through the patent office and appeal them through the courts.
So after you finally got that microprocessor patent, you made a deal with Philips Electronics to license them for royalties. How did that relationship come about? Did you ever consider doing it on your own?
First of all, it wasn't only the microcomputer patent. Philips licensed a portfolio of 23 of my patents, which included the microcomputer patent and other ones. I also had some patents on the personal computer and a whole range of diverse products. I recognize Philips as being a world-class intellectual property company. They had multitudes of patents of their own, and I was not in a position to license my patents myself. So I thought that it was a great opportunity to give them a license for their own use, and which they paid for, and then to take responsibility for licensing other companies. And they were very successful at that.
So did you approach them and kind of suggest that arrangement, or did they approach you?
I had been working with Philips for a short while before. They wanted a license for themselves, and then they decided that they would offer, and I accepted, to try and license my patents to other companies. Unfortunately, they believed that it would take years of litigation before they would be able to generate capital. Yeah. So they gave me some upfront capital to keep me going with my research and development while they went through what they expected would be years of litigation, which never happened because it turned out they were so good at what they did, other companies came forward and took licenses early on.
That's great. So I mean, at the time, you start getting some press attention, your successful licensing efforts, outside of obviously, you know, companies like Intel and Texas Instruments who seemed unhappy about you obtaining that patent. Was there a point when you started to sense that others were unhappy as well? And I'm talking about policymakers, USPTO officials. Was there a point when you started to sense, well, you know, I finally got my patent, I'm successfully licensing it, and I'm getting all this negative commentary about it?
Very definitely. You're right on point. The patent office was unhappy because the press was criticizing them for the 20 years of delay in issuing the patent, and they weren't skilled enough to point out that those delays were caused by the appeal process. The most unhappy people were the Japanese. They were unhappy because American independent inventors were getting patents and they were having to take licenses. And they lobbied Congress and the PTO unmercifully in the early 1990s. And they were instrumental in changing the patent term in order to reduce the value of patents.
That's interesting. So it was really the lobbying and the public relation efforts by these large Japanese companies that kind of turned the tide in the United States about the attitude that they had.
That was a large part of it. Also, I understand that the large American companies, the what they call the tech companies, were also lobbying Congress. Commissioner Bruce Lehman, who was head of the patent office at the time, signed an agreement with the Japanese that he would work with Congress to get the patent laws changed. And in fact, he did.
I guess what they accused you was of using what they called submarine patents, and I think you're saying it's nonsense, that's not what you were trying to do at all. But that was the law. The law was that however long it takes you to get the patent, you get the 17 years from the grant date. Do you think it was wrong if a patentee actually wanted to delay the grant of their patent? Under those laws, do you think there was anything wrong with that kind of behavior? It seems completely lawful to me.
I don't really know. There are a lot of charges lying around about latches, which is intentional delays, yeah, and things of that nature. But in my case, I was a victim of the system, which was a system that delayed patents. My dilemma was that the patent office is used to giving patents on complex ways to do complex things, yeah, and those are impressive. My talents are finding simple ways to do complex things. And once you disclose a simple way to do it, it no longer is impressive. I'd like to mention a very true story. I was talking with a venture capitalist as to what I could do with one of my inventions. He said, "It's impossible. Nobody can do that. Show me how." And I did on pencil and paper. And he looked me straight in the face and he said, "Oh, well, that's easy. I can do that."
Yeah.
So my dilemma is I come up with simple ways to do complex things, and nobody appreciates a simple solution to a complex thing, which is, in a lot of ways, I'm led to believe, the epitome of what invention is.
And I think there's another point too. So if you come up with a simple, elegant solution and you describe it really well, then the patent examiner understands it really well, and they're less likely to grant a patent, while if you file a patent application that's complete nonsense, they can't understand it, and they're more likely to get granted a patent. Do you think that comes into play as well?
Oh, definitely. If you come up with a complex solution to a problem, it's a more impressive and easier to get a patent. If you come up with a simpler way to solve a complex problem, then the problem goes away, and where's the invention? So it's a dichotomy of attitudes.
Do you think, is there anything that the USPTO can do about shifting their attitude? Because obviously the simple, elegant solutions are the ones that make the actual difference to our world.
Now, actually, the patent office is counterproductive in that. Their patent office is encouraging the patent examiners not to grant patents on those things. For example, in the SAWS program, a program that they use to illegally prevent unfavorable patents to issue, they actually encouraged their patent examiners not to grant patents on pioneering inventions and inventions with broad scope.
And inventions that might get media attention, which is kind of funny because if you come up with a great innovation, it's going to get media attention. But the sauce program, which you mentioned, which is a sensitive application of a secret program that the USPTO had in place, was designed to kind of prevent those applications from those patents getting granted. To me, it's interesting. Obviously, a big part of what I want to discuss with you is how you became aware of the sauce program. So by the time you got that microprocessor patent, you had about 400 other applications pending at the USPTO, from what I understand. At what point did you kind of get suspicious that something was off about how your remaining patent applications were being processed and examined at the USPTO?
I had gotten a continuous stream of patents being issued, and then all of a sudden it stopped. In 1997, and not a single additional patent has been issued to me since that time. The information that I have is that the patent office made a decision, no more patents for Hyatt. At that point in time, I had four patents in the process of being issued. Yeah. One had actually issued, and the patent office pulled back all four of them, reopened prosecution, and they're still pending now, almost 20 years later. After having a whole string of 70 patents issued, at a point in time, 1997, having that string stop cold and four issuing patents being stopped from issuing is a very serious fact situation.
So it seems now we know that the sauce program was put in place in 1994. So it took about 3 years until you kind of realized that you were being subjected to it.
No, the SARS program was a secret program. My understanding is the patent office knew that it was illegal, yeah, and therefore they kept it totally secret, and it wasn't brought to the public's attention until about 2012 or thereabouts.
Right. But I'm saying in 1997, you realized, well, something is off because, you know, I've been getting all these patents granted, and all of a sudden it just stopped. And you said you were about to have four more issued and something happened to those. Was it in a matter of months that you realized this, or did it take you a few years to realize, you know, something is fishy going on? It's not just this one particular patent application. It's just more of a systematic thing that's going on. I guess I'm trying to get a sense of it.
Yes, it was pretty clear that something strange was going on, but I didn't have any insight into it, and there was no historical basis for what was happening. So I was confused as to why this was happening. But I did believe that if I continued to diligently process my patent applications, that eventually right would prevail. Unfortunately, the patent office is too powerful, and right did not prevail, and it persists to the present day.
So from what I understand, even though you realized there was some kind of change, you said, well, I can still work with the patent office to get these patents granted. I guess, did you try to talk to the examiners to find out, well, you were about to issue this patent, why was it not being issued? Did you talk to the examiners at that point? Did you talk to their supervisors, to the TC directors? What were they telling you?
I did all of that, and apparently the SARS program was in effect, but they kept it secret. Nobody told us the reasons. They gave me and my associates courtesy, but they just did not issue the patents. I later learned that there were what they call SARS flags that prevented patents from issuing that were SARS flagged. I am told now that all of my patent applications had been SARS flagged at a very early time.
And, you know, sometimes I talk to examiners and they kind of give you insight about what's going on. Like, you know, my supervisor is telling me I can't grant this patent application or whatever. Did you ever get any kind of hints from them or from the examiners or from the supervisors, kind of, you know, about anything being fundamentally off, that, you know, you were I think as your attorney said, you were being stuck in this administrative purgatory with your patent applications. But did they give you any hints that something like that was going on?
Yes, I was working very closely with a director, a group director, Jerry Goldberg, in the mid-1990s, and he got me onto a special program they called the interview program, where patent examiners would call me up, interview me to try and get insight into the invention and try and get early issuance on them.
Yeah.
And I did get calls from examiners, had very good conversations with them, and was led to believe that the patents would issue, but they didn't. In addition, there were several supervisors that were assigned to my applications, and they were supposedly working with me and my associates to further the prosecution of my patent applications.
Yeah.
But I found out later that they were assigned to stop them from issuing rather than to expedite the processing and issuance.
So if I understand this correctly, so all these examiners and supervisors and even you mentioned a TC director, they were all pretending like they're working with you, they're trying to help you, but in reality, they were all doing the exact opposite. They were not going to grant those applications, and you never got any sense whatsoever that there was any kind of program to systematically prevent your patent applications from issuance from what they told you.
That's exactly true. They feigned trying to help me and my attorneys, but in the background, they were delaying the patent applications, and they were finding all kinds of ways to stop them from issuing, in addition to the SAWS program.
I mean, we discussed the most common thing that they did in terms of stopping you from getting your patents issued is when you would appeal within the patent office, when you would appeal an examiner's decision to reject your claims, they would just reopen prosecution, and then the process would start over again.
Right? Exactly. I appealed to the Board of Appeals in the Patent Office. The board reversed the rejections, and in the normal process, they should have issued those claims that the board reversed on. But in fact, they let those patent applications sit. They delayed and delayed, and then they reopened prosecution rather than issuing them.
Yeah, and I'm guessing when you tried to contact them about reopening prosecution, again, they gave you a runaround. At that point, did you have any contacts in Congress or any other parts of government which you said, can you help me find out what is going on?
I did try and get to the Board of Appeals and to the courts, trying to get them to do what was right. But the Patent Office blocked me in that. I generated appeals and appeal briefs, hoping to get a remedy from the Board of Appeals, and they would not let my appeals go to the board. I generated over 1,000 petitions, which is one of the processes that needs to be followed. Over 1,000 petitions, and they would not decide those petitions, and they just let them sit, or they dismissed them, because if they decided them adversely, I could go to court and get an independent judgment. But so they got rid of my petitions without letting me go to court. And I was blocked. I was trapped by the Patent Office. They wouldn't prosecute my patent applications. They suspended them. They suspended them time after time after time. They wouldn't examine them. And they would not let me have my remedies of getting to the Board of Appeals and the courts.
I guess I'm saying that before you went to even thought about going to the courts, did you try to go, I don't know, to somebody in the Department of Commerce, to your congressman, and say, this is what's going on at the patent office, something's fishy going on, can you help me, can you help me figure out what's going on? Did you try to do any of that?
No, I didn't. There's no real process to do that. Congressmen, from my experience, won't get involved in internal agency actions. And the Commerce Department would have said, although I didn't contact them, would have said, you've got your remedies in the patent office. Use your remedies there. I did not believe that they would intercede.
We mentioned it, but the program was started in 1994 by USPTO Commissioner Bruce Lehman. Do you have any sense about what, I guess, motivated him to create SAWS?
From the documents that I've seen, he was concerned about being interviewed by the press when certain patents issued, and he wanted advance warning, and that's why they called it a warning system.
Oh, interesting.
But in fact, it was not a warning system. It was a system to stop controversial patents from issuing, not to warn him against them. And that's what they did to me. They stopped my patents from issuing.
So from what I understand, he was getting he got some bad press about some patents, and he said, well, let's put this program into place to kind of, so I'm prepared if any other patents like this would be issued in place. But this then turned into a system where these types of patents, the pioneering patents and so forth, that are likely to make news, were stopped from issuing altogether. Is that assumption about what happened?
That sounds about right. In recent communications with him, he called the SAWS program a scarlet letter. It puts the SAWS flag puts a scarlet letter on a patent application so that it illegally cannot issue.
And I think you mentioned he works for you as a consultant. Have you had a chance to talk with him one-on-one about how did you come up with this idea? Did something go wrong in the implementation? Have you had those kind of conversations with him?
Not directly.
Yeah. I guess one thing that kind of struck me about this is that, you know, after this program was put in place, there have been so many other heads of the USPTO and others obviously involved in administering this program, from examiners to supervisors to technical center directors. I guess, are you surprised that none of them stopped it or said, you know, this is wrong, we shouldn't be doing it? Does that surprise you?
Not only did the directors not stop the SAWS program, it's my understanding from information that I now have that they actually proliferated it. For example, I have documents that say that Director John Dahl... John Dahl was director in the mid-2000s, about 10 years later. He extended the SAWS program to the Board of Appeals so that an applicant who is appealing to the board, instead of getting an independent decision, the board was told about the patent office's dislike for that particular patent application. It was kept secret for the applicant. The applicant wasn't able to brief it in his appeal briefings, but the board had standard operating procedures that required them to consider these secret SAWS abusive reports.
And this was 10 years later after it was put in place. And do you know what motivated him, I guess, John Dahl, to kind of expand that program even further, make it even more systematic?
That's a major problem with SAWS and what the patent office says is a retirement of the program, because the program became institutionalized. It was part of the patent office society. It was All the examiners were required to be trained in it and retrained and retrained. All of the new hires were briefed on it. So SAWS became an institution in the patent office, in my opinion, from the documents I've seen. And therefore, rather than seeing it as a problem and that they need to correct, they saw it as their right to stop patents from issuing that legally had passed the Constitution, the patentability requirements. The law says very simply, a person shall be entitled to a patent unless certain patentability conditions are not met, but the SAWS conditions are not included there. And once you pass those patentability conditions, the patent has got to issue according to the law. SAWS then adds a whole list of secret other conditions that are not lawful to the requirements, and the patent office culture accepts that as being their right. So therefore, I don't believe they ever looked at it as a problem that needs to be corrected. They looked at it as their right to decide beyond what the law requires, some additional requirements.
Yeah. So the program finally came to light when a FOIA request was filed in 2014, and the USPTO admitted that the program existed. But going back to my question, it seems that, and you said it's systematic, it seems thousands of people at the USPTO were involved in administering this program. All the examiners, the supervisors, the technical center directors, the commissioner of patents, everybody on the appeals side as well. I mean, does that surprise you that somebody out of all those thousands of people didn't say, you know, this is wrong, you know, I need to blow the whistle on this going on? Before that, it was revealed in 2014. No one out of these thousands of people came out publicly and revealed the existence of the program. Does that surprise you, I guess?
No, it doesn't surprise me, because that's how cultures work. And as the culture expands, as time goes on, as new people come in and are integrated into that culture, they don't question it. It becomes a fact of life, and they blindly follow it. We've seen that in the past in political situations that are horrible examples. And here we have a situation where they institute a secret process, educate everyone in it, and it becomes part of the culture, and they don't realize that it's a problem and don't try and correct it.
And I came across a quote from a former Commerce Department Inspector General Todd Zinser. He obviously called the SAWS program unethical, but he also said, as part of a program, supervisors, and you talked about it, were directing their subordinates to mislead or misinform the public. You know, I guess, in one sense, all right, they said, well, there should be this extra standard for granting patent applications, so that it doesn't lead to bad press. But on top of it, they were actually directing the examiners to lie to inventors like yourself. I guess, is that also just part of the culture that kind of was created?
Yes, it is. The documents that I've seen are emails back and forth telling the examiner asking what should he tell the applicant about SAWS, and the supervisor saying, don't tell him about SAWS, don't even mention it. I forget the exact words, but tell him it's just another review. But then we get even worse than that, because Director Kapos told the Congress that they were actively working on pre-GATT applications, but in fact, the pre-GATT applications were SAWS flagged, and my applications that were pre-GATT were not being worked on. They were being suspended. So he misrepresented that to Congress. And then Director Lee told the Senate about SAWS and that she decided to retire it, but she misrepresented what SAWS was.
Right.
It was the attempts to hide SAWS and to misrepresent it went to the very top of the PTO.
So what, I guess, how did Director Lee explain what the SAWS program was?
She said it was a minor program that, I'm trying to do this from memory, that was not very effective, and therefore they were retiring it, when in fact it was agency-wide, end-to-end, top-to-bottom, even out to the Board of Appeals, and it was not a minor program that was not affected. And then there were the PTO, the documents I've seen show that there were thousands and thousands of SAWS flagged applications, and then once you get it into the culture of the PTO, I believe that there are tens of thousands that of applications that are harmed by the SAWS culture.
So I found something else interesting that she said. She said, you know, after the SAWS program was revealed, inventors like yourself came out and said, you know, can you please identify what applications were flagged in the SAWS program? And she said she didn't want to do that because she didn't want to color those applications in the public's eye. So she made it seem that the reason she didn't want to identify those applications is because she didn't want to hurt the patentees. But the patentees were the ones asking for her to identify the applications. I guess, do you have any thoughts when she said that? What was your reaction to that?
That's right. She was trying to cover up, but we're trying to uncover it. I have just been part of a filing of a class action suit to get the PTO to disclose the SAWS material to the applicants that are harmed by it and to pay them remedies for the harm that was done. The PTO actually took a much, much worse position that after delaying the secretly delaying the patent applications through the SAWS program, then go forward and blame the applicants for the delays.
Yeah.
And that is something that will be corrected through this class action suit.
Yeah, and I guess I want to get into that a little bit more. But I guess before we do that, I guess I wanted to talk about, so the application, the program was ended officially in 2015. Did you see any change in how your applications were being processed after it was officially ended? Was there any change?
I don't think it was officially ended. From the information I see, they took the flags that were named, had SAWS names and sensitive names out, but they the other flags of the same nature, I understand, still persisted, and they had flags called the Gilbert Hyatt Group, which focused on my application specifically. And so my understanding is that there's probably a lot of non-SAWS named flags that still existed. And besides, you can't officially end a program by just saying we've ended it. You've got to change the culture. And the patent office had a 20-year culture of SAWS, as we spoke about before, and I haven't seen any documentation indicating that they tried to change the culture or that they even told the examiners with internal memos or anything that SAWS was ended. So the SAWS culture, from my experience and from my, still prevalent in the patent office.
Something you mentioned, and it came out in one of your lawsuits, not only were your applications identified for the SAWS program, they actually created their own Hyatt unit within the USPTO for your patent application. So instead of each patent application being judged on its merits, whatever those merits, right or wrong, those patent applications were being judged based on whether they liked or disliked the inventor, it seems, right? Is that... how do you see it? And it seems there were also other arbitrary rules put in place in terms of, you know, making you limit the number of claims and so forth. It went beyond that, I guess. When you found out all this information, I guess, how did you react to that at that stage?
The PTO formed an art unit. Yeah. Normally, art units are technologically oriented, yeah. But they formed an art unit, or they took an art unit, and they call it formally the bulk filers art unit. Yeah. And then they talked about it as they called it internally the Hyatt unit. And they concentrated all of my applications, most of my applications, in this art unit. They generated special requirements for me to have to go through. They came up with special examiners that they gave raises to. They relieved them of their obligations for performance and such in order to get them to work on my patent applications. And in fact, it turns out if they ever issued my patents, and then the patent examiners would be demoted and reduced in salary. So they were given special promotion, temporary promotions and temporary increases in salary to work on my applications. And when mine were finished, they would be demoted and reduced in salary.
I mean, that's mind-blowing for me to hear that. You know, I guess my experience with the USPTOs has been very different. But I guess, how did you react when you found out all this information that the USPTO was devoting so much resources and to prevent you from, you know, getting the patent applications that you believed you deserved? What was your reaction, I guess, from an emotional state or, I guess...
I was shocked because these things were very unusual and I believe illegal that they were doing. I filed lawsuits in order to stop them from doing these things, both to me and to other applicants. I filed appeals to the district court. The district court had three of my patent applications and ordered that the patent office issue all three of them. This is an order from what's called an Article III constitutional court. And the patent office, rather than issuing those three patent applications, has now appealed it to the Federal Circuit, which we're in the process of litigating.
So they're still continuing to resist, and I want to talk about that. But can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with this legal strategy? I know your attorney is Andrew Grossman. Maybe you can tell us, how did you meet him? He's obviously not somebody who practices exclusively in the patent field, but how did you meet him and how did you come up with a strategy, I guess, for what was happening with you at the USPTO?
Mr. Grossman is an expert in administrative law, and this is, to a large degree, administrative, which means the law that's followed by, my understanding is, it's the law that's followed by the agencies. What the patent office was doing was violating the administrative laws that govern them. Right. Then they followed these laws for other applicants, but they broke these administrative laws and for certain other applicants that they wanted to keep from getting patents.
It seems you have a lot of different lawsuits going on. In the course of one of those lawsuits, you actually went up to the Supreme Court and you won a 9-0 decision. Can you talk about that? And, you know, finally, after all these years of battling in the PTO, in the courts, is a major victory for a patent holder at the Supreme Court. I guess, what was your reaction when that happened?
Yeah. Yes, that was a marvelous case. That was the second and unanimous decision I got from the Supreme Court. And it changed the nature of the appeal, the patent appeals to the courts called Section 145 appeals. It completely changed them. It forced the patent office to follow the federal laws of civil procedure. It confirmed that an applicant can bring in new grounds, new evidence in such an appeal. And most important, it established that an order by the federal court to issue a patent dominates over the patent office's position. The patent office has always taken the position that it has the final word. It is the gatekeeper of issuing patents. The federal judge said, no, I am ordering you to issue these patents.
And obviously that's what you're looking for. So You won that battle, but right now you have other lawsuits where, you know, you're appealing decisions from a federal circuit to the Supreme Court, filed a cert petition. You mentioned that you also filed 2 days ago, we're recording this on June 20th and June 21st, and June 18th, you filed a class action complaint. There's so much going on. What is your ultimate, I guess, goal or strategy with all of these lawsuits? How could it be resolved, I guess, to your satisfaction?
The main way to resolve it is to have the patent office follow the law and stop breaking the law. The additional thing is to get the patent office to respect the rights of the independent inventors and the small entities. Right now, it's my belief, and there's a lot of evidence to support it, that the patent office is prejudiced against the little guys. For example, in the SAWS program, we have found from the patent office's own documentation that the small entities are discriminated against many, many, many times more than the big entities on the SAWS program, and that the delays of the applications for the little small entities are much, much greater than for the large companies. And this is a particular problem because the small entities tend to give up much more quickly because they just don't have the resources, and they get frustrated very easily. An independent inventor whose patent applications are delayed year after year after year and his attorney fees keep mounting, is more likely to just abandon his application.
Yeah, we talked about how many directors there have been since this program was put in place, but at least the Trump administration and Director Iancu, you know, they're at least from my perspective, they're the most patent-friendly officials that we've had in a long time. They put a lot of effort, it seems, to restore balance to the system. There's a new director, he put a new solicitor in charge at the USPTO. Did you have any hope that once they came in, they would resolve these issues and you wouldn't have to continue with these lawsuits?
We have tried. There has been some progress in reaching an agreement, and then the Patent Office broke the agreement. So therefore, it's very difficult to work out an agreement with an agency like that. But
you said at a certain point you thought you had an agreement. Who was it with, I guess, at the PTO?
It was between my patent attorney. It was a minor agreement, yeah. Not a major one. But even a minor agreement, they would not abide by, between my patent attorney and the supervisor.
Oh, okay. I guess, well, now you have this attorney who's in charge of administrative law, Andrew Glossman. Has he tried to talk to the solicitor's office and say, you know, this is ridiculous, this is the story, let's figure out a way to resolve these lawsuits? Has there been any conversations like that?
There has been a prior lawsuit where the Patent Office made promises to the court and broke those promises. But I'm not able to talk about litigations currently in process.
Okay. Let me know if you can talk about it, but I guess, let's say you were magically the director of the USPTO for one day. What should they be doing now in terms of the legacy of the SAWS program? I mean, how should they be resolving?
They should be trying to change the culture. They should be educating the patent examiners that the SAWS program was wrong, that they should change their attitudes, that small entities, and including independent inventors, are to be respected, not to be despised, and to give them equal rights with the large companies.
Let's say somebody from the USPTO is hearing this podcast, and you know they say, you know, it doesn't seem right what happened. We want to try to resolve this. What a way to be resolved is if they agreed to, if they made the final decisions on appeal, would that be to your satisfaction? If they made whatever decision they would, and then you were able to take it to the courts.
Let me explain it with an example. They did let a few of my patent applications go through appeal to the Board of Appeals, yeah. And I was then able to take it to the courts.
Yeah.
The court spent an enormous amount of time, actually 4 weeks of trial, in addition to all of the pre-trial and post-trial things, ordered them to issue three of my patents,
yeah.
And they refused to issue those three patents and have appealed it to the Federal Circuit now, appealing the extensive efforts by this great federal judge, Judge Lambreth. It's pretty clear to me that their attitude is still no more patents for Hyatt.
I took a look at some of the briefs that the USPTO has filed. It's, you know, I was surprised by some of the arguments they made. They actually said, you know, a company like Apple turned it into some kind of imaginary victim. You know, to me, I found surprising that's a way to convince the courts. What do you make of these type of arguments, I guess, that, you know, these big tech companies are the real victims in this?
They're struggling to try and make and support their position, and they come up with foolish arguments. For example, in patent claims, you have a claim that has a combination of things. And just because one of the words in the claim is the name of a product that's out there, they say that, the claim covers that product. Not so. You have to look at all the details of the claims, because inventions are, as one of the great judges said, only God works from nothing. Man must work from old items.
Yeah.
And therefore, you can't just look at a word or a phrase in a patent claim and say, aha, this covers everything. You have to look at all the limitations in the claim, because every claim is an improvement on old things. They're struggling to make arguments that just don't make sense.
A few final questions, I guess. Going back to we discussed how the SOS program came about, you know, Bruce Lehman, I guess he was getting bad press about some marine patents. Now you look at the government, for example, what the FTC is doing in terms of, you know, going after companies that they think are collecting too much royalties on patents. Do you see any parallels to your situation? Why do you think there's, you know, a recurring discomfort among some public officials with the concept of how, you know, the patents work and licensing and so forth?
No, the situation is one where I invented certain technologies. I'm due patents on those that pass the patentability requirements of the law. Yeah. I have never sued anyone for patent infringement, and I am entitled to patents on my inventions that pass the law. And in fact, as I said, the statute expressly says, and a person is entitled to a patent unless certain patentability requirements are not met. And my patent applications meet these patentability requirements. So it's an entitlement that I should have to a patent.
I guess I want to take it a little bit outside of the patent field. Obviously, what's happening to you is horrible, but I imagine if something like that was happening at the DOJ or somewhere like that, it could have even much more grave consequences. I mean, what are the lessons that the U.S. government and Congress should take from your experience in general about how agencies operate and so forth? What advice would you give them?
Be strong on your requirements that the agencies follow the law, and do not excuse the agencies for breaking the law.
We're doing this interview right before you're about to head to court for another court hearing. I guess my question, what keeps you going? Do you ever think about just saying, well, I gave it my best shot, but this is really not worth my time to keep fighting this battle? What do you think keeps you going? And
reforming government is worth everyone's time, particularly my time. And these are reforms that I think are necessary, and I'll dedicate my life to making them follow the law if I have to.
My final question is, you know, I had a friend come to me recently, and he says he has some great invention. And I started telling him about, you know, all the difficulties with, you know, filing a patent application and then enforcing that patent once you get it. I mean, what advice would you give him about whether, you know, it's a worthwhile journey?
I have advised independent inventors informally, not in a professional sense, that the cards are stacked against you unless you're willing to dedicate your life to it and most likely lose. Don't pursue it, because the system is stacked against the independent inventors. And if I could, Thomas Edison would be turning over in his grave if he knew what was happening today.
Well, I think it's a sad but important note to end on. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for listening.
Definitely.